Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, July 12, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear about a layered model of adjudication and enforcement of net neutrality with the FTC, DOJ, and state AGs. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Rosalyn Layton, Visiting Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and our moderator, Alex O'Culiar, Partner at Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe. I will turn it over to Alex to get us started. After opening remarks, we will go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Alex. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura, and welcome to everyone on the line for today's teleforum brought to you by the Federal Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group. Today's program is entitled The Layered Model of Adjudication and Enforcement of Net Neutrality with the FTC, DOJ, and State AGs. We are honored to have with us today an esteemed guest and expert on Internet regulation and enforcement, Rosalyn Layton. Rosalyn is currently a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. She's also a PhD fellow researching Internet economics at the Center for Communication, Media, and Information Technologies at Aalborg University in Copenhagen, Denmark. Rosalyn is a part of Denmark's industrial PhD program, a special initiative of the Ministry of Science, Innovation, and Higher Education to support research of both academic and commercial value and to facilitate knowledge transfer between Denmark and the rest of the world. Welcome, Rosalyn.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Rosalyn, by way of background, in 2015, the FCC, under Chairman Tom Wheeler's leadership, passed net neutrality rules on a 3-2 party line vote, reclassifying broadband internet provision as a telecommunications service under Title II of the Communications Act. At the time, Chairman Wheeler said the FCC was using, quote, all the tools in our toolbox to protect innovators and consumers, end quote, and was attempting to preserve the Internet's role as a core of free expression and democratic principles. He also said Internet access was, quote, too important to let broadband providers be the ones making the rules, end quote. So with that background in mind, Rosalyn, let me ask you a few questions. First, what problem or issue did the FCC's net neutrality rules seek to address?
So, well, thank you for that background and introduction, Alex. You know, what's funny is that the FCC, imposed Title II, which was put in the Communications Act of 1934, which set up the FCC. It was at the time a statute created to manage common carriers, you know, this idea that there's only one provider in the marketplace. And so what was interesting would be if you were going to impose those kind of rules, you might do a kind of market assessment to see is there a natural monopoly to justify using those rules. But they never did that. We have 4,459 broadband providers in the United States, multiple sources of broadband, but nevertheless, the FCC went ahead and imposed a set of rules designed to manage a natural monopoly without establishing that case. Now, of course, that is part of, some of the justification for the many lawsuits against these rules. But what I would say is, you know, if those of you who are following Twitter today, the Internet, you might see that this is called the Day of Action. I like to call it the Day of Distraction. But we have had since 2015 this Title II in place on broadband and 9 lawsuits as a result. They were upheld in the district court. But this is really, I would say, not a part of an ongoing advocacy campaign to impose Title II on the Internet going back since 2005. So there are a group of companies, advocates, academics who believe that, you know, the only way to deliver communications is through a government-run national broadband network. That's a very different view that, you know, many of us in the Federalist Society believe that, you know, there should be a free market. There should be many competing technologies that this should be allowed to emerge in the marketplace. Consumers should decide how it should work. So we have two very different competing visions of what the Internet should be.
So, Rosalind, what, if any, changes over the past couple of years have the FCC's net neutrality rules brought about to the U.S. Internet ecosystem and to the regulation of broadband commerce in the U.S.?
Well, for one thing, well, certainly we have politicized regulation. I mean, I think there's always been politicized regulation. But perhaps most significantly for people who follow this issue is the uncertainty we've created for investment. Since 1996 to 2015, we've had $1.5 trillion in private investment in broadband. And I'm maybe that doesn't mean very much to people, but that's about one-fourth of the world's total. So that's an extraordinary number that the U.S. is responsible for, you know, about a quarter of the world's total broadband outlay every year. And that number increases as the world's total broadband amount is increased. So that was generally under a certainty that there would be a light touch, if you will, a Title I framework where there wasn't a threat that, you know, that the FCC would come in and regulate prices or unbundle networks or, you know, tax broadband and do things like that. So perhaps the, so one economist estimates that we could be losing something on the order of $30 billion a year in lost investment and activity because of these rules. That's really significant. The FCC, in an effort to roll back the rules, they have pointed to a decline in investment of about 5% amongst the 12 largest providers. That's quite a lot. And 75,000 lost jobs, whereas companies who said they just weren't going to deploy infrastructure and they laid off their employees. I think over a period of time, I think over the last decade, maybe 100,000 lost jobs, a lot of them union jobs, at companies where they're deploying infrastructure. That has been the case. So, you know, that can be quite significant, particularly if you believe that we could use more broadband in rural areas, if we think this is so important. And then we essentially create regulations that deprive the shareholders of the value of their investments. They can't use the networks the way they were designed. They're not allowed to price it to be efficient. They can't experiment with new technologies, new prices, and so on. So I think that that's probably the biggest change that these rules have created.
And Rosalind, you mentioned a 5.6% decline in investment and 75,000 jobs lost, and that the FCC has reported on that. Is that something that our listeners could find easily on the FCC's website?
Yes, absolutely. If you go to FCC.gov and you will enter the search term Internet freedom, it will bring you to a page with all the various statements, and there's a fact sheet. I think you can even put into a Google search or any search engine Internet freedom fact sheet, and you can see a lot of these figures. In the current notice of proposed rulemaking, there is a in the NPRM itself, it lists a number of these from multiple sources in looking at the declines in job loss, declines in investment, various studies where it's cited. But I think just intuitively for anybody can understand, if you want to invest in something and then you regulate it with a set of common carrier regulations, that you as an investor, you have just made an investment that now has less value. So that's not an attractive investment in the future. Just by way of a background, in other countries, when this kind of thing has been done, typically the government has to compensate the private the shareholders for their loss of investment, because then if you put in a new network and you use government funds to do it, or you say, well, we're going to change the model, you know, you invested under a set of assumptions over for a generation or for a long-term time horizon, you've essentially changed the assumptions of the environment. So in the case of Australia, when they did a national broadband project, they had to compensate the private shareholders for their loss, which ends up being about 25% of the entire subsidy, the entire cost of that major program. The FCC's done nothing like that, and it even just comes out and says, well, not the current FCC, but the Wheeler FCC said, no, we actually think these rules will make it better, that they'll increase investment and they'll increase innovation, they'll increase your shareholder value. I mean, we know that that's not the case.
Okay, so, and you may have already tipped your hand on this one, Rosalind, but given your background, all the research you've done, what is your reaction, your take on the need for the current net neutrality framework?
Well, I'm trying to, going back to the 2015 reading over the justification again and again, and you know it is kind of going in circles. But you know, so we have a kind of circular reasoning. The internet's really valuable. We need to protect it so it keeps staying valuable. Not sort of recognizing that, you know, it was the kind of a free marketplace that allowed it to emerge. But the FCC itself purported that there was this virtuous circle of innovation, specifically in that term, which, you know, we cannot find referenced anywhere in the literature, but they kind of made it up and said, you know, this is what's driving, you know, everything that goes on. Now, I'm sure we can all have different views about what's a virtuous circle of innovation, but that was accepted in the court as a, you know, as legal justification for these rules, even though we have no real empirical or academic justification for it. So we're sort of living with that kind of background. But when you look at theories of innovation, theories of investment, they have nothing to do with what the FCC talks about. So there is this gulf between what the academic world would say and what, you know, the policy or regulatory world would say.
You alluded to an NPRM, which I believe is the one that everyone's talking about, with Chairman Pai having announced a proposal to repeal the FCC net neutrality framework. I believe there's a public comment period ongoing that ends next week, July 19. What is your understanding of the specifics of the chairman's proposal, and in particular how it would, propose to reclassify broadband services?
Right. So I'm glad you brought that up. If I'm not mistaken, I believe it's the 17th that comments are due. But in any case, it's coming up very soon. And if you are going to file, you do need to do it quickly because. And don't wait to the last minute because there's expected to be a crush of, you know, that's up over 5 million comments at this point. And so just keep that in mind. In terms of it's another interesting point here. I think it could have been possible with the three commissioners there, that the chairman could have done a declaratory ruling and just have taken a vote. That just said, you know, we're now reversing back this imposition of Title II onto broadband and taking a vote at an FCC meeting. I think that he didn't want to do that because he wanted to show himself that he was a sort of anti-Tom Wheeler, in the sense that he wanted to make the rules or the reasoning behind what they were doing transparent so that everyone could see. And this is a critique of how the Title II was put in place under President Obama, which was basically a long set of rules that was never allowed for the public to see. Even the commissioners, the other voting commissioners, at least the Republicans, I think they had a couple of days or if that to be able to review them. So I think that there's some symbolic importance for the chairman about how he's doing it and why and the reasoning there. But the NPRM does make plain that there is a desire to reverse the classification of broadband under Title II, to return it to Title I, they ask a lot of questions inside of the NPRM so people can make comments on why was, is broadband a telecommunication service? Is it transmission between two points without change? Is it an information service and why? So he's asking for more comments on all of those things so that, you know, the very specific legal arguments and challenges can be addressed in the record. So in addition to the removing the Title II, you know, the good part about that it would trigger FTC jurisdiction, so we don't have this case where there's, you know, no protection in place for if broadband providers would do something evil, could, you know, the FTC is there. It would also probably resolve this challenge we have, this conflict around privacy. The other thing that the NPRM proposes is removing the bright line rules. These are the no blocking, no throttling, no paid prioritization. But I believe it also proposed to remove the transparency rules and the Internet conduct standard. And, you know, I would certainly support that because, as we might explore, there's a lot of areas where the FTC and the FCC have butt heads around jurisdiction because they both would police the same bad conduct, but they're going after it with different terms and then sort of double fining some entities. And then I think the important addition that we've seen in this NPRM is the incorporation of cost-benefit analysis into any regulatory decision. It might seem like just basic, well, why wouldn't we, if we're going to impose an entire regulatory regime on an industry, would we not do some kind of regulatory impact assessment? Well, you know, the prior FCC didn't even think that was necessary at all. That's not the view currently, so there's an idea that we should have some kind of cost-benefit analysis of, you know, what kind of regulatory regime that you take and why.
Thanks, and thanks for clarifying that the comment period ends on July 17, just in about 5 days here. So if the current proposal at the FCC, you know, were to pass, what, from your perspective, would be the implications for regulation of broadband? In other words, building on what you were alluding to earlier, what new set of rules at the FCC would take the place of the existing net neutrality rules and framework?
Well, I think that Chairman Pisa says it very well. There was no problem before that necessitated the need for rules in 2015. So there's no need for new rules from the FCC at all. I mean, Congress didn't intend for the FCC to regulate broadband. They were very clear in 1996 that literally that the Internet should be free and unfettered from state and federal regulation. So the FCC actually doesn't have to do anything here. We have ample rules, statutes to cover any kind of a bad conduct through the Federal Trade Commission. We're going to talk about that today. You know, all the other existing agencies. I mean, there's no shortage of laws to go after bad actors in this country. So the FCC doesn't need to make anything new, and I would argue they should steer clear of you know, they if anything, they need to downsize, and that has been to some extent, since President Trump has started his presidency, he has requested the agencies to make a review of all their regulations to see what are the ones that can be retired, what can be sunsetted, and so forth. And that's a really important exercise. Not that this is necessarily something that applies, but the sort of two-for-one idea, if you're going to make any new rules, you have to reduce two things. So I think the FCC should be very careful about any new rules that it makes, certainly on this issue.
You spent years researching broadband regulation and enforcement issues. Recently, you've been discussing the topic of today's call, a layered approach to enforcement that would replace the network neutrality framework. What is a layered approach?
Great. Well, I'm excited to talk about this today. And this term, layered model, I'm going to give credit to Baron Soka of Tech Freedom. I'm not sure who actually coined it or you know, how, if you use it in the legal profession, but I think it's a good way to think about things, that we have many layers of rules and regulations. We have many layers of agencies. We have many layers of law enforcement. We have many layers of standards to apply to police the Internet. We don't need to create a new one, you know, just for this particular thing. So I think that that's the important thing to keep in mind. What is, in the big picture, why is it so preferable? Well, first of all, we want to use the, you know, we want to enforce the laws that are on the books. I mean, I think that that was a big critique of during the Obama era. There was a lot of legislation or rules that we had was not enforced, and agencies made a lot of new regulation. That was certainly the case of with the FCC. But I would also say, from an economics perspective, it's a relatively low cost to use the existing frameworks that you have rather to invent new ones. And that is because you leverage the existing institutions and their expertise. Also, as we know, the FCC is built on an economic and evidence-based standard, a competition standard for everything that they do. Unlike the FCC, which, you know, if you're taking a presumption, you're sort of making a prediction about how the market will be in the future, you know, you have a high risk for regulatory errors. That's very costly because you misdiagnose a problem, you assume one set of issues, and it turns out to be something else. So there's a very high regulatory cost. It's a high cost to do business, a high cost of making these mistakes. The other thing I think which is valuable about the FTC approach, and I could give you dozens of reasons, but I think that's important, is that a competition approach to a marketplace is just by definition one that evolves over time. It recognizes, you know, the multi-sidedness and convergence of the markets rather than the sector-specific view, which sort of sees that, you know, if, you know, only communications companies deliver communications. We know that today all kinds of companies, all sort of industries deliver communications. So I think that the layered model is much more robust to respond to how the marketplace evolves and to be a much more appropriate to what's actually there. Now, of course, the counter view is, well, if we don't predict how it's going to be, people will get hurt. You know, that is really just a kind of unfounded precautionary principle. We have a lot of ways today. We have a lot of ways to gather information to see how things are going. And, you know, if anything, we have quite a bit of evidence, as I've said before, that the FCC approach with Title II has been harmful, not just for investment and for lost jobs, but it's been harmful for consumers because they pay more in broadband than they need to. It's harmful because they're denied innovations and technologies that they could have. They're denied business models that could give them other ways to get online. It's also harmful for innovators, and I think we'll talk about that today.
Well, thanks. So what are some of the specific advantages that you see in a layered model over a net neutrality regulatory framework?
Right. Well, first and foremost, the reason why you want a layered model, or let's say a competition approach, is that you promote competition in the marketplace. Now, maybe that seems obvious to people, but I think many forget about what is that supposed to do. It's supposed to protect the sources of competition that drive the innovation and dynamism in the marketplace. Versus an idea that, you know, you need to enshrine or control things to work a certain way. So fundamentally, I believe that if you want to have a free market for people, that means that they have freedom of choice, that they can choose different ways to connect online. They choose different ways to, for how they buy broadband. The price of data fluctuates. It's bundled in different ways. Some of it could be free or discounted, sponsored, what have you. So, you know, that's important because that's a very important view, as opposed to something that says, well, the FCC will decide broadband needs to be this way. It should be a single fiber-to-the-home network managed by the FCC. I mean, those are two very different worlds about the communications reality. So first of all, being able to deliver a free market for consumers would be a key of having a layered approach. The other would be promoting innovation. And I'm sure even in 1996, nobody had any idea of, you know, what life would be like 21 years later. Here we are in 2017 doing a podcast. I think it's quite significant. We had a recent FedSoc teleforum with Dan Berninger. You know, he is one of the co-inventors of voice over IP, the technology we used in Skype and Vonage and so on. And his app is effectively banned by the FCC with the current rules. He's attempting to put high-definition voice behind platforms so people can talk in real time when they read the news and so on. But he can't operate his app because he's not allowed to buy paid prioritization. And so he's suing the FCC under kind of a free speech argument. He's not able to speak. So the whole reason you'd want to have a layered approach is you would allow the emergence of new kinds of technologies, and before you would shut them down, at least you'd have to make the investigation that there was some harm. I mean, presently, we're not even able to try Dan's new platform, and, you know, that's quite unfortunate, because if anybody knows what was what changed the game in telecommunications was the introduction of voice over IP. You know, I think it's something on the order of 70% of all long distance takes place over voice over IP, Skype-like solutions. I mean, there's a tremendous change in the marketplace, in the ecosystem, in the dynamics and the economics to be able to use digital technologies instead of analog technologies.
Are there any examples in the U.S., recent examples in particular, in which antitrust or consumer protection, perhaps enforcement, has been able to address otherwise what would be perceived as network neutrality issues, like foreclosure, for example?
Sure. Well, I mean, and I'd love to have anything you want to add on this or our listeners, but, you know, all of the issues described in the Bright Line rules of net neutrality, blocking and throttling, paid prioritization, these are bread and butter competition issues. I mean, any competition person who's taken an introductory class on competition law would be able to recognize those things. And they have been discussed and litigated and described for over a century at the FTC and, you know, longer in the history of the Sherman and Clayton Acts. So these things, if anything, net neutrality is just a dressed up word for what we know around denial of access, refusal to supply, exclusionary content, and so on. And we have plenty of cases, even recently in the last year or two, where we've seen these kind of issues where the FTC has been able to step in and apply the relevant antitrust laws or make the needed remedies. I think certainly the McWane case was interesting. This had to do with actual pipes, and they were a supplier of the fittings for the pipes, and how it was that they refused to supply those fittings or the pricing that they engaged. That would be quite similar to if you were an ISP and you had certain content that you wouldn't deliver to the end user. So, you know, that would be similar to a blocking situation. I think what the net neutrality rules miss is that we have these issues where large content providers, they are able to refuse to supply their content or to withhold their content or to discharge these, you know, extraordinary prices and so on. And what I think that you miss with the net neutrality approach is that you assume that the only place that there's market power is within the ISP itself, and you just ignore this whole other world of, you know, the content providers, many of whom, well, in fact, almost all of them are larger than the ISPs. So there is the irony there that, you know, that the Netflixes of the world, you know, it's bigger. Netflix is bigger than any cable company. You have Amazon, so they make their own content. The Googles, they have their own communication networks, Facebook, and so on. So, you know, the concern has been overly placed on the telecom sector, the cable sector, when, you know, there's market power issues in other places. So in any case, blocking is there. Throttling, I think we've seen a lot of activity, most recently with this case against AT&T Mobility. And what's interesting is the throttling practices, it's the idea of degrading or slowing down a particular stream content or data. And that would also fall into, if I'm not mistaken, the sort of FTC's unfair and deceptive practices notion that if you're promising consumers one thing and you don't deliver, or you're acting in a deceptive way, you're slowing their content and they don't know it, that certainly falls squarely within the FTC jurisdiction. And there is a case with the FTC challenging AT&T Mobility for offering unlimited contracts, and then that allegedly that the speeds were throttled as people approached the it was supposed to be unlimited, and then they didn't receive unlimited service or such an idea. So the FTC has certainly taken issue with that. But in any case, there is, you know, if you look at what many have considered, what are the, you know, garden variety net neutrality violations, we see that over time, net neutrality advocates keep adding more new things that they don't like. So, for example, zero rating. Well, we don't like it that you're giving something for free. Well, consumers tend to like that. Under the Wheeler FCC, there was, you know, going after, like, T-Mobile had a free music service, which was very popular. Was open to any kind of music streaming services. So, you know, FCC was trying to find a way to shut that down through its open internet rules. They didn't succeed. But, you know, in other countries, they have, just in one case, you could look in India, where, for example, Facebook was offering a free service for, you know, people who'd never tried the internet for the first time. Activists succeeded to shut down that service in India, unfortunately. But in any case, those issues can certainly be taken up within the FTC under all these concepts of margin squeeze, predatory pricing, consumer protection issues, and we have a variety of cases where they had been addressed. Certainly, you can also look at the TracFone case. There was another case of unfair and deceptive practices. I think TracFone was fined something like $40 million for offering a prepaid service, and people were not able to use it as it was billed. So there's no argument here that the FTC doesn't have the knowledge or capability or the authority to go after abuses in the marketplace when it comes to what we would consider as net neutrality.
Rosalyn, a lot of your research is focused on broadband regulation in foreign jurisdictions. What are some examples of models you think have worked well in your research in terms of, for example, spurring innovation, investment, network stability? And conversely, what are some examples of models that you've seen that have not worked as well along those same dimensions?
Well, thank you for asking that question. So I think what's been significant is that we've had a lot of experience of countries making soft net neutrality rules. And I think it's very interesting why, you know, there's about a dozen countries that very early on, in the, before, you know, around 2009 or so, the Nordic countries, Japan, South Korea, Switzerland, made these soft net neutrality rules. It's just sort of my term, where they've used a multi-stakeholder model or codes of conduct, self-regulation. And I think it's quite significant because those are certainly countries where there has been a high level of network investment, and there was a concern that making net neutrality rules were premature or unjustified, but it was a way to sort of make a, how would you say, a win-win amongst a variety of stakeholders, so that if, you know, people in advocacy community were concerned that, you know, ISPs were going to hurt consumers, there was at least a place for a dialogue or a forum. And then also it was an opportunity for ISPs to sort of stand up and say, hey, we're going to agree to this code of conduct. You can hold us to it. And by the way, if we don't hold us to it, obviously you can come in and regulate us. So there's a sort of carrot and stick. So there was quite a bit of success with those kinds of models. And what I find unfortunate is in the whole race in the United States to, you know, turn everything into a common carrier utility network, that the advocates who have so long said everything is better abroad, they completely ignored and purposely ignored the very successful soft regulatory regimes that have been in place for, you know, 7 or 8 years now. But since 2016 in the European Union, a law has been passed, quite to the chagrin of a number of European regulators who felt that the European laws were a step backwards, particularly Sweden, where they have a very strict transparency regime, where they believe that as long as consumers have very low switching costs, you don't need to make net neutrality rules, things are disclosed. They had built a transparency regime from the ground up with the consumer advocacy community, with the ISPs and so on. And then fortunately, that was, you know, goes away as a result of the EU rules. I think probably the most successful example is Denmark, which had a self-regulatory regime where the operators, the Telecom Industry Association, they took the first step and said, you know what, we're actually going to agree to this code of conduct, which is tougher than a lot of the regulations that are around the world, and they have never had any net neutrality violations. There's nothing on record. What's also significant are those countries with soft rules. There's been no litigation. So I think that's important from a legal perspective, is it's low cost to the society, it's low cost for political risk. I mean, I'm sorry, it doesn't mean that, you know, the lawyers don't get billing, but, you know, from a kind of equilibrium point of view, that's a much better way to go, maintaining the low cost of regulation and law enforcement. Where have the rules not worked so well? I mean, and this is what I would say, countries that have used hard rules, whether they have regulation or legislation of some kind, they would make a typical Tom Wheeler argument about, we need these rules to protect what's worked really well without any rules. We need it to guarantee our innovation. You know, and there's no evidence of that. And in fact, we've seen the countries with the hardest rules have the least to show for it in terms of they have no new innovators. They have no new applications. There's no new edge providers that have resulted. If anything, you have more concentration of the existing content that was there before. So in many ways, the rules are counterproductive, and they end up deterring the very innovations that we thought we would get. For example, the Dan Berninger case with the voiceover IP, with the high-definition voice. So, you know, we also have cases where countries that have no rules at all are tremendously successful in creating innovation. Look at China. You know, I'm certainly not advocating their method of the great, you know, firewall and how they lock down the internet, but there's no doubt that the Chinese internet companies are extremely successful and innovative. Americans actually download more total downloads from Chinese companies today than from American. And so there's no rhyme or reason that says you need net neutrality to create innovation, because there's far too many examples around the world with no rules at all, and yet they have all kinds of new edge providers, if you will, all sorts of new content providers in places that never had rules. But we don't have any new examples of some new content provider that emerges in a country that had hard rules.
If you had to boil it down to a single characteristic that you've seen in your research that would explain why some models, maybe like the soft rules model in Denmark, have worked well, while others, maybe like the Netherlands, have been less successful, what would that characteristic be?
Well, I would put it very simply, the countries that have more commercial freedom in their marketplace and their ecosystems, they tend to have better results. If in fact your results, the results you want to have are innovation and adoption of broadband. So, to make it plain, I looked very closely at Denmark and the Netherlands. Denmark, which had taken a self-regulatory approach from 2010, versus Holland, which said, we're going to make a hard law and subsequently make it even tougher. And we're going to slam down ISPs. We don't let them partner. We don't let them offer discriminatory pricing. They can't offer these different kinds of free offers and so on. Well, interestingly, 5 years hence, you can look at Denmark, which has 1/3 higher rate of mobile broadband adoption on postpaid 4G devices than compared to Holland. Denmark has delivered, about half a dozen global killer apps. The games that they make, Subway Surfers, is used around the world. They have made a kind of a Endomondo with a fitness solution, a takeaway delivery. But there's nothing that's come out of the Netherlands that is a global app that you could name. But you probably use a lot of Danish-made innovation. But essentially, what has really not anything to do with net neutrality, it's just the complementary assets, in the sense that in Denmark, the mobile operators have freedom to partner with different content providers. They have freedom to price. They were one of the first movers in offering free data as a means to get people to try Facebook when it first came out. So they were very aggressive about how to get people online, use a mobile phone, and buy a postpaid subscription rather than a prepaid subscription. So you create in that country a critical mass of users with, next generation networks and devices who can try your apps when you make them. So that is really, if you want to create these great results, you need to allow the complementary assets in the free market to work where the different groups will find a partnership. And there's no way that the regulators know in advance where those connections are going to be. But if you allow a marketplace where there's freedom for those different assets to find each other, whatever it may be, and freedom to price, to make an offer in the marketplace, you end up better off. Where I think it's particularly been a sad story is in the Latin American countries. They're already poor. They have low rates of investment. They've put these rules in place where, less than 1% of their content and apps are made locally. And so here we are 5 years later, they've had these rules. These regulators are waking up and saying, this is not working for us. We are not helping to grow our own digital economy. We can't get more money to invest in broadband. We can't, different groups use our networks. We can't tax them. So it's really been a sad thing for the poorest countries of the world who put in this policy through a lot of populism. It sounded great, save the internet, and so forth. It has not helped those countries themselves.
Shifting back to the U.S. and the current discussions going on at the FCC, if the agency were to move beyond a network neutrality model, are there any initiatives, rules, enforcement approaches, based on your research, that you might recommend to the Chairman Pai or to the agency more generally? And if so, what might those be?
Well, what I would say, I would strongly discourage the FCC from making any new rules. And if anything, when I've studied the list of complaints at the FCC, the number one issue is robocalls. And fortunately, I think the Chairman Pai recognizes that. He's focusing on robocalls. And there's an area where you can't even regulate to solve the problem. You need to create safe harbors so that the ISPs themselves can deploy the technologies that they need to block the robocalls or other ways to identify malicious callers and things like that. So if anything, The FCC is, even if you're looking from a pure sort of consumer protection perspective, you know, what, how do you want to help the ecosystem? Net neutrality, which is accounting for maybe 7% of the complaints, they're not even about, people don't complain. Nobody can't get the content they want. What they say they want is more competition to their home with more technologies. So the rules put in place have nothing to do with delivering more competition to the end user. If anything, the FCC should focus on robocalls. But here again, the FTC may be even the better vehicle for that, because let's say last year the FTC managed 5 million robocall complaints. The FCC managed just 200,000. So I think even as a enforcement agency, the FTC does a lot for, you know, you get a lot of bang for the buck, if you will. But what is valuable, at least, I'm thinking the FCC side, is they will understand there's certain ways to, you know, to ensure that, you know, you don't, there's a safe harbor at least, so that the ISPs can experiment with the tools that they need to block robocalls.
So let's shift back to looking at the layered model a little bit and maybe drill down some on the practical implications of having that kind of a model, the potential limitations maybe of a layered approach. Things that may bear some additional thought. So, for example, in your experience and from your perspective, do you think that the agencies, the FTC, the DOJ, the various state AGs, do they have the bandwidth to sort of monitor and police net neutrality issues effectively?
Well, so first of all, I wouldn't suggest that any regulatory agency needs to monitor the networks to look for violations. I think the beauty of the antitrust approach is that it, when a problem is there, it will make itself known. And we certainly have a lot of ways to, you know, any, I mean, we know today that, you know, there's a very active online community that polices anything that they think is abuse. So they move very quickly. So in terms of, so, you know, right away, we can already see the premise. There's not a business model, if you're an ISP, to harm your consumers. It's really not a, it's not a smart thing to do. It isn't profit maximizing. So it doesn't need to take a lot of bandwidth from the FTC or the DOJ or the state AG. So these are very, the FCC itself could only name four violations. They were very minor. Two of them never materialized. So there's not really a problem, you know, something that we're holding back and all of a sudden we can never get online and never get our content. The other thing I would say that would be appropriate about the layered model is that, you know, we have 4,000, almost 4,500 ISPs around America. Most of them are not national. Most of them are small. They are confined to one or two states. So it's actually much more appropriate that any kind of, if there was something would emerge, that it would be managed at the state level and not take up the federal resources. In fact, it's quite a bit of overkill if you're just the small ISP serving, you know, a handful of customers. Why do you have to be regulated from Washington? I mean, it's really, it's not a good use of, certainly not a good use of the FCC's time. I mean, we as taxpayers, we're spending about $250,000 at least for every FCC employee. I mean, that's most and more families make, you know, in the United States. So we also need to consider where is the best use of our taxpayers, you know, money in terms of where we deploy the regulatory resources. Should they be closer to the problem and appropriate to the problem if and when it does emerge?
A lot of people have been talking about the FCC and the common carrier exemption to the FTC Act. Would the common carrier exemption to the FTC's jurisdiction under the FTC Act create any problems in terms of effective enforcement?
Well, we've seen that, you know, this is already a problem now. I mean, as I said at the beginning of the call, that we have these very different competing views of, you know, what is our communications world supposed to be. One is a free market view and the other is a kind of what I would call a government monopoly view. So this whole business with the FCC putting, you know, broadband into common carrier has created a lot of a lot of disjunction in the sense that the timing of it and when it happened. So the AT&T has been has been charged both by the FCC and the FTC for the same issue, if I'm not mistaken, but the FCC put it under the transparency rules of net neutrality, and the FTC used their unfair and deceptive standard. So, you know, same issue, but come from two different agencies with two different sets of rules. That's, maybe it's great if you're, you know, you want to work in the law field and you have a lot more job opportunities. Maybe that's a good reason for that. But if you're the company, that's not a good thing. If you're the taxpayer, that's not a good thing. We are double paying. We're driving up extra, using our extra resources to, you know, go after the same problem with different agencies. So that's, that I think is very problematic. The, you know, just in general, that we even are talking about common carrier in 2017, when all the other industries that had previous common carrier designations have largely been relaxed and sunset, you know, in the trucking, transportation industries, airlines, and so on. We have, you know, we have lowered the barriers to entry. Technology makes it quite inexpensive to be able to get into business. So this whole common carrier assumptions don't apply anymore. And as long as that stays, I see that we're going to have these kind of problems where you'll get people who assert, oh, you know, that broadband is a human right and it's common carriage and needs to be regulated, and that makes it very difficult. That I also think there's a challenge because it's walling off the really legitimate issues where the FTC may need to have antitrust enforcement, but the companies are going to use this as a shield that says, well, you can't go after me for some other thing because I'm a common carrier and I'm exempt. And I think that's one of these issues in this case with AT&T Mobility. Is common carriage based on it one of your business lines, one of your activities, or is it your status? If you're, so, for example, could Google say, well, I have one business line as a common carrier, Google Fiber, and therefore I'm a common carrier as status, so you can't go after me, FTC. Now, I don't mean to, you know, go too far into it. I'm sure you could weigh in, or one of the listeners. But I think for me, from the policy and economics perspective, that is really a, that's not a good thing for the point of view of an efficient efficient marketplace.
Well, let me ask you, you know, based on something that you said in terms of efficiency and efficient enforcement, I mean, the layered model, I think, contemplates a number of different agencies policing conduct on the Internet. Is it more efficient, from your perspective, to have multiple agencies involved in this activity, or is that in this enforcement activity, or is it just, is that just inviting turf battles or jurisdictional issues, maybe differing priorities or prosecutorial behavior? Is there a risk that you could create possible confusion among consumers or businesses subject to all these overlapping jurisdictions? And if you do see that as an issue with the model, you know, how would you address it?
Well, I mean, I think we already have seen the problems. I mean, I'd love to hear, you know, some of the listeners will weigh in on how the, on how they see it. You know, I mean, I guess I could take, well, what's the counter view? Well, you know, many people, let's say if you're a, you know, you're one of these common carrier folks, you'll say, oh, well, you know, there's more to life than efficiency and economics. And, you know, these are just, it's the statute and that's what it says. And, you know, that because we get to do it. Well, then I would argue, you know, are you necessarily making the situation better? And I think that's where we have to come back to, is the, you know, government monopoly of broadband a better way to go? And even if we take that kind of connotations aside, we have a lot of countries that have experimented with this, and it's been a disaster, you know, that have tried to do, you know, build national fiber networks to the home, all under these ideas that it's neutral and recession-proof and everything under the sun. And, you know, the other interesting thing is, meanwhile, you have many emerging countries who are, people will say, well, the first and only way they'll ever get on the Internet is a mobile phone, which has a completely different set of assumptions. It's not a common carrier. It's not a natural monopoly. You can set up a mobile network quite inexpensively, as a matter of fact, particularly if the spectrum allocation is inefficient. That's because the value chain for a wireless service is very very diversified. There can be firms at every single level of every part of that value chain, and it really requires very little involvement from the government other than, you know, to get the licensing done. So you don't even need a telecom authority to do it. You just need some ability to deliver a license. So this whole assumption that there that this is a common carrier status is not the case when we can look at, you know, dozens of countries around the world. I think where you can even look at a country like Denmark, which dismantled their telecom regulator in 2011. This was done by the center-left government because they said, you know what, we're not adding value here with these all of these telecom people micromanaging the network. They're smart folks. We're going to get them to work in the cybersecurity section or the finance ministry or other departments where they can add their expertise. So I think there's an opportunity, you know, those people who believe that, you know, this telecom lawyering is really important, well, you could actually work in different places that you see how do different functions can enable broadband to do things better. And that was the way the approach they took in Denmark. So there hasn't been a telecom regulator now for 6 years. Not only has it not ended, the things continue in Denmark. It was named the number one digital nation in 2014, unseating South Korea. So, you know, we actually have real world cases where actually delivering through the first assumption of telecom regulation, which is to deliver a competitive market, remove the common carrier status, and turn it over to antitrust, where they have followed those steps to a large extent, not perfectly, but had a good result. So I think rather than talking here about the wishful thinking, we can actually look at following the linear model that's there and seeing that it works.
Should we go to audience questions since we only have 8 minutes left?
Yes, thank you.
Great. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first audience question.
I understand the FCC is now taking steps to try to reduce the barriers that the local governments throw up to becoming an internet service provider. One of the reasons that it is a limited supply is that the cables, that last mile, are regulated by the locals, and they like to be able to extract their bribes for the privilege of doing business. Would you care to comment on that?
You're absolutely right. I mean, that has been, it's one of these terms called this dynamics of interventionism. It's this notion about, you know, the problem of regulatory intervention is it creates, you try to solve one problem today, it creates problems in the future. So, for example, to get the cable franchise at one point in time, which was, by the way, for television, not for broadband, you had to agree with the municipality that you'd build out to all the homes in the area. You had to give kickbacks to the city council, you know, a whole litany of things. And, you know, interestingly, you know, when Google Fiber went into Kansas City, they said, well, we don't want to do any of that. In fact, we want you to pay us. Well, wouldn't it be nice to the world work that way? But in any case, that is a real issue. And if we look at the world of broadband deployment, there are layers, talk about layered model, there are layers of state, federal, local regulations that make it very difficult to deploy network. I estimate about 25% of network is not built because of barriers on the ground. We can just look at, for example, a federal lands, 29% are owned by the government. We don't have a standard way that we can be able to get rights of way on federal lands. That's a challenge. Spectrum itself, 2/3 of spectrum is owned by the federal government. It's not able to be used for commercial wireless services or wireless, you know, services of any kind. That's quite inefficient. You know, in fact, what we use for our commercial mobile is something on only about 15% of the available spectrum. So if you want to talk about making an open internet and creating competition in a free marketplace, we would have a boon of opportunities just getting rid of the federal and local obstacles that get in the way. Where this is really a problem is now we're going to 5G, and we have a lot of challenges with at the local level where you need to put up a small cell, and then, you know, the city will say, well, it's our right, and we can, you know, we want to have $5,000 for every small cell, you know, and you have, if you want to use that. And so it's counterproductive in the sense that if you want your community to have broadband and you want it to be inexpensive, you need to have a way to deploy quickly and at low cost. That is going up against the notion about communities have a right or sovereignty to define how things get done in their community. You know, is that just a front for trying to shake down companies that are there trying to build this infrastructure? So I take your point. I don't have the magic bullet for it, but other than I would say it is a real problem. My colleagues and I study it. We try to address it. We have found cases where, you know, some communities make cartels where they band together with other communities to do a price cartel for deployment of infrastructure. So there is a there's a lot of things. You know, it's quite ironic that we say that the ISPs are the ones who are the troublemakers. I mean, it's the pot calling the kettle black, because we have a lot of challenges with municipalities. And maybe in some cases it's not, you know, they're not purposely trying to do that. They may see, oh, historic reasons or architectural reasons that we wanted, or aesthetic, environmental, what have you. So there are definitely lots of competing concerns. But this is also a case of, you know, do we accept that broadband is very important, we need to get it deployed quickly, then we need to expedite how we do it. This is perhaps a case maybe where the FCC could play a role, and I think that they're working on that, where they're trying to fast-track the sort of norms and standards about how do we deploy at a local level.
I'll make another call for questions. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any. Alex, do you have any more questions you'd like to ask?
Yes, I have just one very quick question. So most of our conversation today, Rosalind, we focused on the economic implications of broadband regulation. Another rationale that Chairman Wheeler advocated for net neutrality was essentially to protect free speech on the Internet. So how do you react to the idea, and do you think that a layered model could adequately protect free speech on the Internet?
I think that's a great question, and it's one that has a lot of, you know, political valence. Anytime you say free speech, everyone's jumping up and down, but I'm sure the FedSoc lawyers, they're very particular about what this means and how you protect it and in which method. So it does raise a lot of serious legal issues if regulatory agencies all of a sudden say they want to protect free speech, because it's not, I don't believe Congress has specified that that's that the FCC has the authority to do that, and they certainly don't have the right, you know, do they have the authority to create rules that let them protect free speech. In the case of Title II, this is perhaps an issue where the FCC is actually violating free speech. We can certainly see that with Dan Berninger, and I commend anybody to check out that FedSoc podcast that was at end of June, at some point in June. Very informative, you know, around all of those issues. But the main reason about a layered approach is it works well because it's supporting the actual competition and the technologies that would support free speech. In the way that the First Amendment envisions it, there should be a multitude of networks and platforms. Concentrating it all under a single government monopoly or entity that the Title II envisions is really the antithesis of the constitutional notion of free speech.
We'll have to leave it at that, because I know that Rosalind has somewhere to be. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. We have another teleforum tomorrow at the unusual time at 12:30. It's a Regulatory Transparency Project teleforum, so be sure to tune into that. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.